So thank you very much for the invitation and for a nice introduction. So it's my first time here on the Institute. Yes, I will give a talk about some kind of foundational work connected to Bayesian stuff. So if you think that this is connected to Cubism, you're half right. It's inspired by Cubism, but at least Chris Fuchs is not very happy about us, which we're not sure whether it's a good or bad sign, but at least it's not. I think when he gave a talk here, he actually mocked us. I think he put that first slide of mine somewhere in the talk and said something bad about us. But so the basic idea, the whole project I have to explain is with Adam Cabello, Giulio Chirabella, and Markus Müller. I think at least these two guys are regular visitors here. And started as an FQXI project on the role of the observer. And we met in Hong Kong a year ago now, and basically ended up after one week of discussions with that whiteboard. And I will by far not explain everything that's on there. Maybe some parts, I don't know, here you cannot read because it's green, but only small parts, and mostly we did not even work it out in detail yet, the other parts. Okay. So I will start by saying what we're trying to do by first criticizing what is the problem with the other framework that we all maybe know. It is the probabilistic framework of generalized probabilistic theories, which is a broader framework containing quantum theory. And I want to make some kind of criticism, or at least why it would be maybe nice to have an alternative to that. And I will review first how this kind of probabilistic framework works, although I guess most of you have maybe even worked on that. So you basically make a very abstract version of quantum theory, where you start to assume only that you have some kind of state omega. In this kind of language, it's usually noted as omega, which in some very broad form summarizes your initial situation of your experiment. So typically, it will be some kind of thermal state. Think of the Stern-Gerlach experiment. We have some kind of oven, so you have a thermal state. This is what in quantum mechanics is a quantum state. Then you do a lot of interesting operations in your experiment. Again, Stern-Gerlach would be you put some kind of magnet, some gradient, and you get some kind of splitting of your beams. And then you make some measurement, and you have according elements, some mathematical elements f, which correspond to a measurement outcome, which would just be the position of the silver atom on your screen, again, in a standard experiment. In general, you can write down this kind of thing basically for any situation which you can cover with quantum mechanics. And what you see is, or what you learn from quantum mechanics, is that all of them are more or less convex sets. This is partially a convention. I think also some people here are not following this kind of convex rule. The basic idea why they should be convex is that you can basically choose different state preparations just randomly and then just say that what you have is a convex combination. And you call this also then you make a corresponding structure of your state space is such that this gives you a convex combination in a mathematical sense of the two states. And the same you can do for any kind of experiment phi or for measurements and measurement outcomes. This is the intuition why all these sets are convex. The good thing is if they are convex, you also have for free a linear structure because you can only talk about convex combinations if you have some linear space. And the main object of desire that you want to calculate if you have this kind of basic framework is some kind of probability for the outcome f to occur under the assumption that you had the preparation omega and the operation phi. So you have just very generally some kind of function which gives you some kind of probability. I will comment on that a little bit later, which depends on the preparation, on the operations, and the measurement. And because of convexity, and you identify this probability with the same probability that you have actually when mixing states and operations, you assume that these are actually linear. So this is part of the framework. Okay. Let me give an example just that you recognize what I'm talking about. So basically, in quantum mechanics, you have two competing pictures, basically Schrödinger 1 for at least for quantum information science. I think in other fields it's more and more some mixture between the two. But okay, so let's go for Schrödinger picture. You have that basically you take your state omega as some kind of fixed, and then you say that you apply some action on that, which corresponds to what you do in the experiment, and then you measure your state. So this is why I go from right to left. You have somehow the temporal order. And in a Heisenberg picture, you have the temporal order from left to the right. So you start with your measurement. You say that the measurement actually is transformed by what you do in the experiment, and you apply in the end the state omega, or your preparation omega, to get the probability. Obviously, both of them are mathematically equivalent, because this here is just a mathematical dual of that one on the other way around. So at least in finite dimensions, these two are completely equivalent. In infinite dimensions, maybe some of you know this kind of battle, I think, also in these axiomatic approaches to infinite dimensional systems. They are not really equivalent, and you have some slight differences. But I will go for finite dimensional, so basically they're just the same, and there is no mathematical difference, whatever you choose. Okay, so the quantum mechanical example is omega would just be a state. Phi would be just some unitary transformation of your density matrix. So you put the unitary from the left and the right. And then you take the trace with your measurement, which is just a kind of projections, to get some kind of probability. And in Heisenberg picture, you do it the other way around. You start with the projection, and you make the unitary backwards, so u dagger u. And then omega is just taking the trace of the transformed measurement with your state. I'm too far away. Okay. The interesting thing to that is that, so this is something in quantum mechanics has. We all know we have the Heisenberg picture and we have the Schrödinger picture. The interesting thing is that although mathematically you have this duality, in concept-wise you don't have this duality at all. So if you talk about the measurement problem, which many people like to discuss without saying what exactly it means, but say that you have discrete outcomes, this is your measurement problem, then if you go to the dual picture, you should have a preparation problem. But nobody has a preparation problem for whatever reason. So seemingly, even I would not even know how to formulate what a preparation problem is. And similarly, if you talk about the collapse of the wave function, I mean, if you take the dual, you would talk about the collapse of the measurement. But also nobody talks about the collapse of the measurement, so there seem to be no duality in the philosophical concepts.
So could you clarify what you mean by the measurement problem then?
I don't have a measurement problem.
Okay, what do you understand by that? Why don't you have a preparation problem?
So the measurement problem usually comes from people which have a strong belief in a realistic model. So they see that the state is somehow something like a classical field. And then you wonder why, basically, if you go for the Stein-Gerlach experiment, why actually in the end the cesium atom is ending up in one of the two places. And this is somehow a surprise from the classical perspective if you see the classical field. This is, I think, what many people consider as a measurement problem. There are other variants. So I don't know how to ask the same question even for preparations.
So how are you conceiving of a preparation? You're not so...
So preparation for me is in this case, is just taking having some oven where just the cesium atoms come out. What is this? Silver atoms is, I think, right? Come out. So that's it's a thermal state. So I have some kind of prior assumption how the state looks like. So I can, that's my state preparation. Other people would say something else, but I would say that.
Right. I mean, so certainly one way of thinking about preparation is you do a measurement, right?
I do not want to do that. Yeah. I do not want to mix up preparation with measurement, like sequential measurements. First do a measurement, and then you have to somehow agree what the post-measurement state is, which is not so easy. So I want to avoid this problem, and I say preparation is something which is really something different from a measurement. So I have to prepare a state, obviously, because otherwise, I just need actually... I thought a while about this. I don't know a good answer, but basically I need some mathematical object I can plug in into this thing. And therefore I need to talk about preparations.
Okay, but even if you have an atom coming out of an oven, that's an abstraction. You need some measurement that actually individuates that atom so we can even speak of that atom. So there's a measurement going on even at that level of...
No, I think I do this in the Stein-Gerlach. I really have my oven, then I have some kind of collimator, and then in the end I just look what happens on my silver screen. I don't think I at any point assume there's a single atom. I mean, in my description, yes, but I don't have to make actually a measurement that single atoms are coming out. I just have a strong belief that this is somehow a mixed function. I mean, it's a mixed state relating to atoms. I don't think there's... Good question, but it would be my point of view. Okay, any more questions? So basically, I would say that somehow there's a non-duality between this concept, at least in the discussion. Maybe you can force to make these duals, but at least in the discussion, we have a very distinct way of thinking. So basically, this is one of the things which you can maybe drop. If you make another picture or another approach to quantum theory, maybe you don't need actually that you can have both pictures. You can just stick to one picture, because in any way it seems that most of us think more or less in a Schrödinger picture in the first place. So I promise that I will say something about the probability. Funnily, I think that actually quantum theory does not say what the thing is if you compute Born's rule. I mean, it says somehow probability, but probability is a very vague term. And I would stick here with the statement that basically what comes out here is a number between 0 and 1, which is, in the best case, real. And it corresponds to what you would have in a Bernoulli tray. So you cannot distinguish it from a Bernoulli tray. Bernoulli tray is just a biased coin flip. The good thing about that in quantum mechanics is because you have just this real number between 0 and 1, you can do two different interpretations of actually your quantum predictions or the quantum formalism, which are frequentist or Bayesian. And just to remember what the difference between the two is in a nutshell, so assume you have some parameterized model. So you have some, say, real parameter x, which just changes your preparation and your whole experimental procedure. And so the probability also depends on x. If you now make some experiment, you can afterwards make some conclusion about a confidence interval, what the actual parameter x has been in your experiment within this confidence interval. This is the frequentist analysis. The Bayesian analysis gives you the opposite, more or less. It gives you a probability distribution, so there's a posterior distribution, over this parameter of your model. So this parameter x, and this probability distribution you can use later on to make predictions what happens in future experiments. So basically, the difference is this is about the past and this is about the future. There has been and there's always a small battle in physics, which one to use. Luckily, in physics, the battle is at least not physically violent. But I think in the end, it's a very good thing. We need to do, I mean, there's a story in statistics. In statisticians study, whatever, beating each other up about this fight. But basically, I think for physics, it's very important. We can do two things. We can rule out models by providing confidence intervals, which somehow exclude certain models with a high probability. And on the other hand, we can invent new experiments just by making some kind of Bayesian analysis and say, well, if I do this in this kind of, this in this kind of setup with high probability, this experiment will give me, I don't know, compute the prime factors of some large number. So maybe both of them are needed. But as you might guess from the title of my talk, most the kind of approach I want to promote here is strongly focused on actually Bayesian inference. Oops. Then there's this distinction, which people, I think this is a modern thing, is the distinction between quantum theory and quantum mechanics. So what this meant by this is that you have on the one hand just the Hilbert space formalism, which just tells you how to compute with density matrices, how to create unitaries if you have your Hamiltonian, maybe even Born's rule, so how to get a probability. But this is not about physics. It's just some kind of rules how to manipulate mathematical objects. And then you have quantum mechanics, which basically consists of the Schrödinger equation in a low energy regime, which tells you how actually connect the things you have in your lab to these mathematical objects. And both parts are very important. Obviously, I mean, this is just the kind of techniques you need to know to deal with quantum theory. And this the quantum mechanics you need to actually really describe physics. The problem with this abstract approach is like general probabilistic theories is that we don't have any mechanics in the sense of we don't know how to create a Popescu rolling box. We have no idea. And the main reason is because these are just abstract mathematical objects and nobody has some kind of dynamical theory of it. Yes, so this is something that we hope to overcome a little bit. This is also connected to a problem in quantum theory, which is called the quantization problem. Are there some high energy physics people here? Okay, but you heard maybe nonetheless about the quantization problem. So basically the problem is how do I associate, so if I have a classical description of my of a given system, how do I actually describe this in quantum theory? And the bad news is that we don't know how. We have some kind of ad hoc rules which apply to certain scenarios, but they are not, none of them are really genuine. There's always exceptions, and there are really cases where different quantization methods give different results, and we just don't know what's correct. Yeah?
Question, first, just terminology. Why don't you call it quantum mechanics? I would have thought that quantum mechanics seems like quantum theory applied to just non-relativistic particle mechanics. But you're meaning it in this...
Yeah, you know, okay. Like it's not my terminology. So what would you call it? Or actually, quantum mechanics, so you associate quantum mechanics with low energy sector. This is your...
Criticism. Yeah, as opposed to quantum field theory.
Yep.
But
yeah.
Also,
criticism taken, yeah.
Terminology. My other question is, couldn't we just say that the connection between what I do in the lab and the mathematical representation is inferred from the statistics? Right. So say I set up something in the lab and I assume quantum theory is correct. I do tomography, I get the representation of that measurement device. So I didn't need to postulate what the mathematical object representing that measurement as I infer it from my statistical data. So why do I need a new theory to connect these? It's just something I figure out in the lab.
I don't think this is how physicists usually work. In the sense of, so my aim is, so I mean, we had a little bit of this discussion in the morning, you don't get full thing, at lunch, you don't get the full thing because yeah, there's some, I mean, you cannot do it without assuming anything because you have some ambiguities there. But my main problem is actually I want to say, well, I want to see a system and be able to understand it or characterize it. I don't want to characterize each component in a device-independent way without understanding what it is. I want to write, so best case is say the hydrogen atom. How do you make a tomography of the hydrogen atom? But I want actually to predict the spectrum for all kind of odd situations. When I put a magnetic field or an electric field, and then, so this kind of level I talk about.
So when you say states, transformations, and measurements are the things that need to be connected with mathematical objects.
Yeah.
When you say state, I thought you meant like a box in a lab that has an output aperture, not a hydrogen atom.
In principle, I think you can also map this to this kind of thing. I mean, if you make actually spectroscopy of a hydrogen atom, you have some kind of, I mean, you just take some gas and put electric current through it, right? So and basically, I think your preparation is also similar. So you have some preparation procedure, you have something which you actually do, which is basically putting an electric current through your hydrogen gas and looking with it through it with some kind of spectrometer. So I think it fits, I agree it's more difficult, but in principle it fits into that thing, but I wouldn't want to make a tomography of my spectrometer because it would take infinitely long, I guess.
The point is that theory that can tell you how to do things like calculate the fine structure constant, calculate
yeah.
the spectra, different elements.
I mean,
so the theory without having sort of gone already and done all this topography, tells you how to do those calculations and gives you numbers. And that isn't contained in what he calls quantum theory. It's only contained in quantum optics or quantum electrodynamics or something like that. And there's something missing from the abstract.
Yeah.
Maybe it's about saying something like what dimensions of Hilbert spaces are accessible, what Hamiltonians on those Hilbert spaces correspond to valid transformations.
Yeah, in some physical theory.
No, the question here is, what is H in the Schrödinger equation? That's my question. That's the quantization problem. For me, not so much the dimension of the Hilbert space. I mean, okay, it's partially determined by H, but the Hamiltonian. You have a question?
Yeah, well, I was running this distinction between your quantum theory and quantum mechanics. I can think of the theory as you say it's working in the space of mathematics. Whereas when you get to quantum mechanics, what you're doing is you're forming an association between these abstract mathematical objects and your physical objects, your physical system. Yes. So it's doing that mapping in the physical system.
More or less, for this part, you can just, I mean, it can also do a mathematician. But for this one, you need some kind of physics education, which gives you this strange intuition about objects. And, yeah. I mean, more or less, what separates mathematics from physics.
Yeah, but you need to make that association between the mathematical objects and the physical objects.
Yes, exactly. Yes, that's what I mean. I understand your criticism because I had been operational before. In principle, still, even if I start operational, I can in the end say, now I want to understand. If I define quantum mechanics as an operational theory, still in the beginning, I can still ask what is the spectrum of the hydrogen atom.
I think the way I would have phrased this formally, and I think I'm saying the same thing you're saying here, is maybe if I take quantum theory as, I have systems of different types. Right? So for instance, I could have electrons, I could have protons, I could have photons, other types of systems. I have, these preparations of these systems, transformations, measurements on all these different types of systems, things that take me between different types. But then I have to, on the sort of mechanics side, I have to tell you something like, how do I represent symmetry groups on these different types of systems, for instance? So how's a rotation represented on this system? What's the reversible
for
these types of systems?
At least for the hydrogen atom, it's basically just point symmetry. Yeah, how do I represent this? Yeah, I agree. Yeah. So definitely this is not, this is more hand-waving than strict, I agree. But I think you get the idea that somehow at least there's something very big missing in the generalized probabilistic theories, because you cannot tell me how to prepare a PR box. I mean, even if we don't know what they are talking about, basically, if you talk about a PR box. Was one more question?
I'm just trying to understand. So you're trying to say that I ought to be able to take, so the von Neumann formalism corresponds to quantum theory, and quantum mechanics would be the non-relativistic quantum mechanics.
It can also be relativistic.
So you basically want to say, tell me how I represent position of momentum. Tell me what the Hamiltonian should be, given the classical Hamiltonian.
Yes, basically. Yes.
And you're expecting to get a variant or a class of equations which are variants of the Schrödinger equation based on different general probabilistic theories. Is that it?
So even if you just start to describe quantum mechanics as some, actually a theory on Z star algebras, tell me how do I now calculate the spectrum of a hydrogen atom. And you cannot do this, basically, because you need to know something about electric fields, make some semi-classical approach, blah, blah. So yeah. OK. Then I say everything is, anyway, this was the last slide of my introduction. So now I will talk very broadly without a lot of mathematics about what kind of discussions we had when we tried to develop this kind of Bayesian framework and what kind of decisions we made. So because obviously, if you try to make an alternative approach, you can do whatever. You have the full set of mathematics in front of you, and you have to choose how you do it. And we made some, I think, quite particular decisions. Which we discussed controversially, and I try to now explain what they are and why we decided like that. So the basic idea is we have some kind of Bayesian agent in a very weak sense. So it's not like agent learning, just some kind of guy who is having basically three key abilities. The agent has perceptions, so some kind of sensorical input. He can be active, in a sense, perform actions. And he can make predictions about the future, what he expects to be true. So these are the, I think this is actually quite common for the agent. The way how the agent performs predictions, so I mean the first three things, two things are just giving basically the agent some information. And the way the agent makes predictions is by holding some kind of model about the world in some sense. And I will talk a little bit about what we expect from this model. So basic questions are, how many agents are there? So this is basically important if you know all the discussion about weakness friend. Have you heard weakness friend discussions? Okay. Basically, our answer will be, we don't care. Then a more subtle question is perception about what and actions on what. So what kind of systems do we consider? Another question, which might not be obvious from how I introduced it here, is actually whether perceptions and actions are different. The problem in quantum mechanics is that a measurement is an interaction with the system. So you don't actually know whether getting information from your system is not the same as just doing something to your system. Okay, then what is the structure of relief models? I just said this. And in the end, how much will we deviate from quantum theory? And the toy theories I will present in the end, if I have 1.5 hours time to speak, will not be quantum theory yet. So this is the warning. So because I always get the question, how does this relate to machine learning? It does not. So basically, did Markus Müller actually give a talk here about his quantum zombies? No. So Markus Müller had a very nice theory about actually how a Bayesian agent can understand the world, even if the world is very complex. And his result is in some kind of toy model, but it's very convincing that basically, independent how complex the world is, the agent will always have a very simple model of the world corresponding to our second order differential equations we have in physics. And so this is not what I'm doing here, because the agent I have is more or less really a theory. So the agent just has some kind of rules which tell you how to update the belief model corresponding to input, and it's not a self-learning machine, and then we have 10,000 agents, and we only let that one survive, which is the best one or so. It's not this kind of machine learning game. Just what I want to say. And to give you an idea of what kind of agent I'm talking about, this is a very naive model. So the easiest way, of course, is that the belief model is just a quantum state. It's also very much what basically Chris Fuchs would say, except that he would take the measurement probabilities for a sick UVM. But it's basically the same as a quantum state. And basically what you do if you have the only action you can do, say, for that very simple model is you have some kind of measurement, and the perception is just the measurement outcome. So the only thing that you can do is that if you have a perception or the agent has a perception, you do the usual state update rule, just projecting onto the subspace of the measurement outcome and renormalizing the probability. So that's basically the simplest quantum agent. And this is how we also think of quantum theory as a Bayesian theory. Why some people say it's actually a Bayesian theory, because this kind of rule you find in any textbook on quantum theory. Then we have to discuss the problem of local tomography, which I don't know how much you're familiar with this problem in generalized probabilistic theories. The fundamental problem is that, so assume you know all correlations of a local system. And you have two systems, and you have measured, you not only have measured all measurements on one system and all measurements on the other system, but you also know all the correlations between them. But you only can perform local measurements. Can you learn the full state of the system? So that's an interesting question to you, Rob. If I measure only locally, can I learn the state of the full system?
That says if you want to be agnostic about the GPT, you go to the lab, you do as many local measurements as you can, and you ask whether they're able to predict the outcomes of non-local measurements.
Yes.
And if you find in the lab, oh, I found a measurement for which its statistics seem to be not predicted by any combination of local measurements, then I say I have evidence for the failure of local tomography.
Okay.
Now, if somebody tomorrow could say, oh, there are some local measurements you forgot, and maybe they're then sufficient to predict the outcomes of these non-local measurements, but until you find such things, you have evidence against the truth of local tomography.
Good. So basically, you explained the concept. Thank you. So the basic idea is what can happen is you make local measurements, you make all possible measurements which you think are sufficient to your theory, and then you make some global measurement and you see you cannot predict the outcome of the global measurement according to the results of the local measurement. This does not happen in quantum theory. Quantum theory is locally tomographic, meaning that if I make local tomography and I know all correlations between the local measurements, I can predict anything that happens in the global system, even if the global state is an entangled state. That happens to be the case. It seems very natural and it's also very useful because we basically can understand the world by decomposing it. But there's no need that the theory works like that. And the most well-known counterexample to that is actually quantum theory over the real numbers. So you can basically start to make quantum theory, but instead of having complex numbers, you just make real Hilbert space and try to develop the same formalism. You run into a lot of problems, and one of them is that you're no longer locally tomographically complete, unless you divide by some factors which do nothing else than just mapping the real numbers to the complex numbers. But if you do it in a strict sense, you will see that you're not tomographically complete. So there's basically, if you're going for general theories, this local tomography thing is something you should be careful with. So that's why we basically abandon it. And in our agent language, that means we just have one global agent. And the only thing that we can do is we can look at subsystems. But we don't expect that if we have two global agents which describe one system, another one describing another system, that these two are consistent or that they can say something about a combined system. We only always talk about one agent for one system. To be more specific, what kind of agents we are thinking about. So the main thing which I want to avoid is to discuss some kind of agent which is for the whole universe, which is responsible to explain everything in the world. The only thing we want to do is actually to explain some kind of small experiments like an ion trap, where we can initialize the CCD camera, we can load some ions, we can move them around, we can put some lasers on it, and so on. So where somehow the set of operations is well understood, we know what we can do, and it's a system we can somehow. We are not part of the system in the sense of as we would be in a universe. So we don't describe ourselves within the system. Correspondingly, there is only one measurement. There's no different measurement settings. Why? The basic idea is, if you go back to that one here, your measurement is your CCD camera. And this is only, you only have one CCD camera. Of course, you can make incompatible measurements here by just applying some laser pulses and rotating the ions correspondingly. But your actual measurement, which is just shining some light on here, getting fluorescence, and then having reading out the CCD camera, is always the same thing. And we assume that this is actually something genuine. You can always reduce physics to have only one measurement. Why are we confident this is the case? Basically, if you look at real experiment in a lab, what you see is always a monitor. And you see the student staring at the monitor. And all measurement results he does in his experiment will always pop up on the monitor. So basically, you can say the universal measurement is just this kind of monitor which just displays the measurement outcome from the experiment. So this is why we think it can work. Okay. I just told this, I think. Okay, now I have to go little bit to a mathematical language. And I see that I'm already very late in time. And how we actually do what I just said in basic terms without formulas. So let me say again what an agent is. So it is equipped with some kind of abstract belief, having perceptions, the ability to act, and some kind of built-in system to change the belief. So this is opposed to some kind of machine learning thing. And the agent can make predictions about the future. So let's start with what are predictions. So predictions are about things that can happen in the future, obviously. So you have some kind of sample space, omega. And what you want to do is you want to have some kind of event space, which is just all subsets of this space, or if you're of the sample space. So if you have some kind of more complicated structure, you have some kind of sigma algebra on your sample space. So this is the kind of, you make predictions over events, which are subsets of things that can happen. Correspondingly, so this is very traditional probability theory. Correspondingly, you have the prediction is actually a probability measure on the set of events, on the 0, 1, so it's a normal probability measure, which is sigma additive. So everything about your prediction is nothing else than just a Kolmogorov prediction. Of course, we want to make predictions based on the beliefs. And the way we do this, and this is an important separation, is we have a belief, but the belief is not this prediction. This is different from what is often done in traditional Bayesian agents. But actually, we have some kind of function which maps this belief to the probability. The reason we want to do this, of course, is we want to have that our belief is something like a quantum state. And a quantum state is not a probability, so we need to have the separation between belief and probability. We have to talk about the other end, which is the perceptions, so the sensorical input to the agent. This is very similar. So it's again some kind of subset of your samples. Which is the same sample space because you're making predictions about your measurement. So these are your measurement outcomes, and these are the subsets of the measurements. And this is a little bit odd because usually you would say your perception is an event. So I have measurement outcome, say I roll a die, and I see it has the side 1 is up, then I say this is my perception. We don't do that. We say that you can also choose to say it was any odd number, so any subset. The main reason, so why do we do that? The main reason is that this is just to have this dissimilarity with the predictions. And later on, if we go for subsystems, it will give us a proper appropriate mathematical structure. So we can do that. It does not harm. And it's later on useful. So if we have some kind of perception, we have to update the belief of the agent. And this is just, we do this very formally. So we have some kind of function which depends on the perception and maps beliefs to beliefs. Now, what the agent can do is he can actually have two different perceptions about the same thing. So first he can think, whatever, this is an odd number I had. And then he can think, it was also a number which was more or equal to 3. So this would be E and F. And then if he applies this to his beliefs, so first there's an odd number, and then it's a small number. Of course, what you get is just the intersection of the two sets. So in mathematical terms, you have a semigroup homomorphism with respect to the commutative group, which is just intersection between the two, in the event algebra. I explained this, I think. Of course, you cannot have contradicting perceptions. That would be very bad. That would be inconsistent, and you will later see that this will not work. How long can I speak, really?
4:35.
Okay. Now I just have to plan what I omit. It's not okay. The most important thing are actions, or which is, I think, sometimes called interventions in this kind of Bayesian framework. So actions are Well, let's go back to the ion traps. There's some kind of shining lasers onto your ion or some microwaves or whatever. So something which basically does a unitary rotation. So again, if you do an action and you have some kind of model of the action, then this will introduce a change of your belief corresponding to the action. Now, there are two important things about actions. The first thing is, of course, they don't commute, because we know that in quantum mechanics they don't commute. Actually, also in classical mechanics, they don't commute. If you do rotations in different axes, it depends in which order you perform. So you have some kind of order. This order does not mean that you have time. It just means you know what has been before and what has been later. We have, this is one of the things we discussed most intensively, whether we should do this or not. In the end, we decided if we don't have this, it will be very difficult to understand what a theory is actually predicting about if we don't have a notion of future. So it might also actually predict the past, so we don't know. So therefore, we introduce by hand that there's some kind of structure here, which allows us to define this function in a very convenient way, namely that it's actually a semigroup homomorphism with respect to performing first the action A and then the action B, which gives us a product. And then we can just define that actually performing one action and the other action is the same as performing an action which is just combined from the two. So basically, this sums up the agent. So we have a belief, we have perceptions, we can perform actions, and we have corresponding transformations. Corresponding to the action, we have y, and for the, if you have perception, you have this map t, and we can extract a prediction about the future from our belief using some function x. So this whole bunch of mathematical objects defines the agent. Now I will do maybe one or two examples how this works in practice. I thought I have another. Okay. This is a warning. This agent is what we don't want. So the problem is with an agent, there's a very simple solution to your problem, and you don't have to do any physics at all. So what you do is you assume I have an agent, say quantum mechanics. I can use quantum mechanics to build an agent. So quantum mechanics predicts me how to change my state according to actions, meaning unitaries and according to measurements. So I define a new set of actions, which contains all original actions and also all experiences. And I include also some kind of trivial action which does nothing. And then I include all products in the sense of between the actions and the experiences. And I define a function set, which acts just as you would expect on this kind of larger set by just composing it. If it's an action, you apply y, and if it's actually what you have in the product, if it's an experience, you apply e. And you can define a belief which contains all possible predictions of all possible actions or experiences of the future on your belief. And you just call this some kind of beta prime f. And then you collect all these possible predictions into one in your belief. So basically, your belief is just anything that can happen in the future. Can do this, of course. Then everything becomes very simple. Your function x is just extracting beta prime u. Your function y just is an update, just selecting beta y. So actually, the subset, which beta e, which contains this action as first element, and the same for the perceptions. The reason why we don't want this is because this is not physics. Of course, I can write this down, but if I have done this, I am as smart as before, because what I want as a physicist is a model. So I want something like the hydrogen atom, which is very elegant and it can make very strong predictions just from what I think how the thing works. I don't want a prediction about everything that can happen whatever I do with the hydrogen atom. I want to know what's the spectral lines. So I want to have a model which has much less degrees of freedom than it maybe should have, because I can do a lot of strange things, which actually my kind of bad. So I think physics is about reducing B beyond just saying what I can. So yeah, it's more than just making predictions, any possible prediction about the future, but it's also about understanding systems. So this is why we don't want this kind of agent. It might, of course, turn out in the end that the only consistent agent we find is of the structure, which would mean the whole program of physics is somehow not working. But we hope we can avoid this. The second example is also a small warning, which is that it might happen that you make a model, and in the end, you find out it is not sufficient for your system. So the example is pretty simple. So consider you have some kind of bipartite system, and you're in some kind of just product state. And your agent is only taking into account one system. So your belief is just the one state on the one side. But your set of actions contains the swap operation, which swaps the first and the second system. Obviously, your agent will be completely unable to make any predictions about the second system. You will completely fail to make reasonable predictions. What this tells you is that you have to be careful that the agent, that the actions are not more powerful than the belief of the agent. And actually, we don't know yet how to handle this in strict terms. But there must be some kind of condition that your system is closed and you can really predict anything in a reasonable fashion. And maybe the last example I do is, let me do the second example. Yes. Which is some kind of quantum agent which is not quantum theory. So we want to, again, as in the beginning, have a very simple model just for the situation where we have a finite dimensional quantum system. We can only make projective measurements and unitary rotations. So what we do instead of storing the density matrix, we actually store the unitary, which has been performed so far. And we store some kind of more or less the probability distribution of the system, which gives you just, well, for the measurement outcomes, but you will see later. So this Q gives you just, if you look for your predictions for your measurement, you see that the probability is just the probability for your measurement outcome normalized by the total probability to have any measurement outcome. If you apply a unitary, this is just concatenated with the unitary you have already in your system. And you add a particular action, which is I measure the system, which more or less just diagonalizes my system by projecting onto the diagonal parts. And the good thing is that the canonical update rule here is nothing else than what you would actually do for a Bayesian agent on your probability distribution. The strange thing about this agent is that it always makes a von Neumann measurement. So it destroys any coherence between, because you have here this destructive measurement. And the other strange thing is it does not really feature a density matrix. It just remembers what kind of unitaries have been performed and occasionally updates the probability distribution about the future measurements. OK. So let me summarize what I talked about. So basically, we aim for doing a probabilistic Bayesian theory, framework for probabilistic Bayesian theories. We don't actually aim to reproduce quantum theory. This is, I think, part of the thing which Chris Fuchs didn't like too much. So if you look back how we described the agent, it is explicitly in the Schrödinger picture. We just update our belief, and the belief is something like a quantum state. So therefore, we are explicitly using the Schrödinger picture. We are obviously Bayesian, so we don't have any ambiguity about inference methods. I don't know whether we will have a quantization problem. Most likely, we still have. Because as you just saw, basically what I wrote down was just some kind of a mathematical theory, and we did not have any physical. Like, I didn't talk about rotations. So basically, most likely, we will still have the quantization problem. The things that we are currently working on and which is the reason why we still don't have a paper on that in the archive, is how can we really treat exactly subsystems. So I didn't talk about this, but this is part of the trick where we hope to get more into the direction of quantum theory. And the other question is actually this time ordering, which we introduced by hand. Is it really necessary? Because in particular, Markus Müller argued that there might be ways to actually infer time ordering from the structure of your system, but we don't know yet whether how, and this is the reason why we actually abandoned this idea for a moment at least. The final question is, will quantum mechanics emerge from this full setup? And if so, is it a good thing? I mean, do we want that we can mathematically derive quantum theory from first principles, or are we more happy if we can somehow have different ways, or there's still some freedom how nature could work principle. Okay, that's all. Thank you.
I wonder if you could actually just simply contrast this with the Bayesian inference framework. So that framework is already supposed to be rather general. It's dealing with propositions which represent states of knowledge that an agent has probabilities which quantify degrees of belief. That seems to me already a framework in which one could do model comparison and apply it to quantum theory.
The main thing is we are more restrictive. So basically, I mean, if you go back to, this is more or less, these Bayesian models are more or less not physics, right? They're mostly for any kind of experimental situation any situation where you want to make predictions, or where do I have it? Somewhere here. This is more or less how they work. And we introduce more structure, more mathematical structure. That's the main difference. So we have certain things we want to make it more specific for physical models. So I think, yeah. So the main difference, I think, is the mathematical structure I said in the second part, which is you don't have, I mean, basically, if you do this kind of models, you end up with this, what I said is a bad model. They just have the predictions, any possible prediction about the future. This is what we are putting in there.
So are you presupposing the Bayesian framework and then putting structure in nouns to constrain it?
Actually, we did not talk about Bayesian yet, but yes. I mean, we did not require that we have a Bayesian update rule.
Okay.
Most likely, it would be good to have it, because otherwise the predictions will be very useless. But yes, so it is from this very broad framework. It is a specialization, more or less having this generalized probabilistic theories in mind and working this kind of direction.
You've talked briefly about memories and the role of memories, and you've got a belief model here, but
yeah.
You've not got a memory or knowledge as part of the abilities of the agent. And it strikes me that if you put memory,
yeah,
which is presumably essential for knowledge, if they make that a requirement, then your time ordering can be resolved by saying you remember, anything that's remembered is in the past.
Yeah, we don't have really memory except that we have the belief model.
Well, so you haven't really defined...
I mean, a belief model is of course a memory. If you want so, because if you just look at how we have these update rules, this is more or less having a memory. Mm-hmm. Yes, but how, I mean, this is actually might be partially lack of knowledge from me for this kind of theory, but how do you actually decide whether you know more than before? If I give you two belief models, how do you know which one? I mean, how do you decide which contains the past? Anyway, if I don't have a notion of past, so the problem is, If I don't know whether I performed this action before the other action.
So the question I would ask is there a distinction between your belief model and history? All of the past.
I can define that. I mean, Yes. So the what I extract as a prediction is the future, and what is in the belief model is the past. The question is whether. Yes, you can. Yes.
So the past has to be completely coherent and consistent within your belief model.
You can call this the past. The question is whether this will. So the consider situation. So the situation we had basically in mind is, okay, it's very hard to imagine, but you don't have any time order. So I just give you a list of actions. I don't say this is some kind of, and I give you a list of perceptions. And I don't tell you which happened when. And then you should make a prediction.
But I'm suggesting.
And you don't even know whether the prediction is about the past or the future.
But I'm suggesting that that all those perceptions, in order to be called perceptions, have to become part of your belief model.
Yes,
the belief model has to be coherent. And to be coherent is going to have time ordering, the history embedded within it.
If I have an ordering of my perceptions, I, of course, this is more or less what we said. We assume we have an ordering, not of the perceptions because they commute, but of the actions. So then obviously I have a time, some very weak notion of time. But the problem is that I might just give you a set of actions. I say five times I did this and three times this, but I don't tell you where. And then the question is whether you can still make predictions. And I also tell you I had some perception at some point, but I don't tell you when, because there's no time going. And so from your reactions, this was also my reaction, most likely this will not work. But it would be very interesting if we would. But we more or less, for the moment, we abandoned this because basically we have enough trouble doing the other stuff. It's just an open question. Yeah.
So you're referring to the reason. You were talking about how your agent is different from an agent in machine learning. But it seems to me like the main difference is that in machine learning, the kind of idea is that the system that you use to update your beliefs is part of the belief, so it can be updated in particular. Do you think that's the case?
Yes. I mean, the main difference is that our model is supposed to be simple. So of course, if you think about machine learning, basically the only thing you need to do is, I mean, you can still say everything that somehow, and now the main difference is maybe that we don't judge the agent. So usually the agent, they're different models. So one of the models is that the agent can actually decide what kind of intervention the agent does at which time in order to learn new things. That's, I think, but this is one kind of model. The other model is where they can't do this, but still, I think you can more or less, I mean, you can more or less this kind of, so if the actions are actually given by an outside observer, so we want to use this kind of more as an oracle. We tell, we did the following actions, we did the following, and we want some answer what is going to happen. You can also put this into the usual machine learning. I mean, what we write down here could be also usual machine learning language, but this is not what we are aiming for. We are not trying to investigate the Bayesian thing, but what we are now looking for is what is a subsystem. This will be the most interesting question, and also how do sequential measurements, for example, occur. So the framework is not so different, but maybe what we are investigating is different.
I'm wondering if you could further contrast with quantum theory. So in your mindless agent, you said that if you simply take your belief model as the quantum state, as the density matrix, that there's a price that you're paying in terms of complexity, and you criticize that.
Now, the quantum state I can take. I don't want to take all predictions. So typically this Bayesian, the Bayesian belief model is typically defined as the set of all possible future predictions, depending on your interventions.
So if you're okay taking a possible agent as somebody who uses their belief model as density matrices,
Yeah.
Then
okay, yeah, for a moment, then, yes.
Why do you have so many more aspects to defining an agent than you do in a GPT? In a GPT, you have these sort of three things, and you had a list of like six things to do in the definition.
In your GPT, you also have much more. I mean,
can you relate them to the terms in terms
in GPTs,
of like this?
In GPTs, so let me see. What do you have in GPTs? In GPTs, you have to specify your set of states, your set of measurements, your set of effects, of transformations. Then you have to specify how to compose systems. And what else do we have? Yes. So the main thing which you lack in GPTs is you don't know how to make predictions, because you only get probability out of it. It's like in quantum theory. Quantum theory just gives you probability, it doesn't tell you what to do with it.
I'm sorry, I'm missing the distinction there between a probability and a prediction.
And probability is not the prediction depends on your prior assumptions about the system. So you cannot make a prediction without assuming something. So in quantum theory, you would usually start with a prior distribution, and then make a measurement, and then update your distribution and make predictions accordingly. This is a Bayesian framework. But you can also do a frequent system analysis and more or less just say, what did you learn from the measurement? But how you actually do this update is, okay, it's more or less given by Bayesian rules. It is more difficult if you want to update your density matrix, because you start with the problem that you don't have a prior for the density matrices, or no neutral prior. So, of course, I mean, quantum theory will. Oh, okay. So I want to say for that, if you don't. Yeah.
So I'm still sort of missing the big picture, because to what extent is this about? So you do call it operationalism, right? Like it's sort of so you grant the existence of this world that you're trying to understand, and are you a realist here? Is what I'm asking, basically.
No. I don't assume anything. But no, I mean, you don't need to assume your. So you're asking me whether I need to assume the existence of the world?
Yeah, like, because...
It helps.
It helps. Of course it helps. So you take it for granted, right? Because I thought Marcus had this more radical suggestion where you don't even take that for granted.
So this is... The main point here is that we are not so esoteric. So we really, this is why I have this ion trap there. So the problem we want to solve is, how can I describe this ion trap without assuming quantum theory in the first place? I don't want to solve the problem of the universe and everything and so on. So I think I didn't think about your question, and I don't want to think about it without your or other things.
If there are no more questions, let's thank Matthias again.